Hi, Dan.
Hey, Bob. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. You're in Washington at some conference?
I am in Washington. I'm actually in Arlington at a conference that George Mason University's law schools put together, where this morning I had to sit and hear an Econ 101 lecture I had not heard for 20 years. But it was, you know, okay to hear it.
Well, I appreciate your doing this while the conference is going on. I feel kind of guilty because you could be doing valuable networking right now, but instead you're talking to me.
I could be, although I think I discovered the actual cause. I mean, for our viewers, I was originally supposed to do this with Megan McArdle, and there were technical difficulties, and I think I've discovered the source of the technical difficulties, which is Jacob Levy.
Jacob Levy.
Jacob Levy is responsible. The only coincidence, I've had one other technical failure in blogging him, and that was one with Virginia Postrel back in the fall. And the only common denominator between those two events was that Jacob Levy emailed me in the middle of both of them.
Ooh.
And he's never emailed me, you know, during another blogging hit. So, you know, I think that's proof enough.
And at
right
the risk
there.
Of sounding ignorant, who is he?
Jacob Levy was a former colleague of mine at the University of Chicago. He was a former blogger at the Velo Conspiracy.
Conspiracy? Interesting.
Yes, there you go.
Yeah,
exactly.
That explains. Now it's all coming together. Jacob and the conspiracy.
Jacob is part of clearly a conspiracy so massive that. That Jacob actually is now a professor at McGill in Canada. And I think clearly, you know, his non-American status is causing him to mess around with blogging.
By the way, Dean, just to rewind the tape a little bit, back when I said I feel guilty because you could be at your conference doing valuable networking and instead you're talking to me, the correct answer would have been, Bob, talking to you is doing valuable networking.
Actually, I thought the correct response would have been, but Bob, clearly you are such a valuable writer and you know, that the lost time that you're having engaging with me, I feel guilty about that. How's that?
Well, yeah, but at least if you had said that, I would have had the presence of mind to say, Dan, talking to you is valuable networking.
Well, Bob, I'm sorry. This is valuable networking time. I appreciate it. Thank you for saying this. I just hope we don't disappoint the legions of Blogging Heads fans that seem addicted to your, you know, that you being sort of exclusive with Mickey.
Yeah, well, it's going to be a hard transition for them. But you and I actually did one ages ago, back in the...
We did one ages ago. This actually raises an interesting Blogging Heads question, which is, I'm worried now that, you know, do you think that the watchers will become, like, addicted to exclusive, you know, do they want to see monogamy among Blogging Heads?
I don't... There's so many bad jokes that could come out of that I'm
which is why I brought it up. Exactly.
I'm not going to utter any of them. actually, it's an interesting question, and I actually full transparency is our motto here at Blogging Head. So let me tell you about a strategic conundrum here.
Okay.
Actually, viewers do, I think, like regular pairs, or at least that's one good way to build an audience, is to be seen kind of, you know, time after time with the same person. But the bloggers themselves kind of like to play the field because, and here comes this theme again, to some extent for bloggers, this is kind of a form of networking. In other words,
yes.
there are people that they have communicated with by email, but they've never even spoken to on the phone, and this is the next best thing to being there.
So, exactly. No.
So you have this irony that probably a good traffic building device would be to do regular pairings, but wanderlust has unfortunately seized most of our contributors.
The only thing I could suggest is maybe you could do it like a baseball season where you would have, you know, semi-regular pairings of Blogging Heads, but then every once in a while you have an exciting interleague schedule.
Exactly.
Whereby everyone, you know, mashes themselves up. Like maybe, you know, 2 weeks out of the month you have regular, you know, discussions, and then 2 weeks, or, you know, 1 week out of the month, you suddenly, you know, everyone goes crazy.
Excellent idea.
You know what you could even do? You could have, like, a public Blogging Heads rolling of the bones. You could, like, literally put the names in a thing, you know, and figure out, you know, draw just two Blogging Heads participants at random. It could be exciting.
Dan, you are a promotional genius. Well, I'll tell you, whatever we're paying you, it's not enough.
Yes, by academic standards, I am a true marketing genius.
Okay, so I guess we were going to talk about actual events.
That's correct.
The most recent highly dramatic actual event was this kind of split in among Palestinians between Fatah and Hamas. Fatah basically took over Gaza forcibly. And I don't know, you haven't been following this especially closely, or?
Well, I mean, I can tell you, I mean, if memory serves, that, you know, as you said, the violence broke out between the two. Hamas basically captured almost all of Gaza to the point where Fatah, there was a stream of Fatah refugees across the border to Egypt. Abbas has now dismissed the old coalition government. He's just launched a new non-Hamas government, which then raises the problem of basically nothing is going to get in or out of Gaza. And over the long term, that's going to be very bad. Have I missed anything? Or?
No, I mean, the good news from the point of view of Palestinians living in the West Bank, I guess, is that the Europe and the U.S. and Israel had been refusing to play ball with the unity government per se, so long as Hamas was part of it, so you might get more funds flowing in now that Hamas is no longer part of it. But, of course, if you're living in Gaza, you worry that maybe things will become worse than ever.
Yes. I mean, I think that I think I saw a headline suggesting that Gaza has at most 10 days, you know, worth of food left if there's no continued, you know, if they can't cross the borders.
Yeah, and I don't think, you know, I think Europe in particular will be taking pains not to let anything very dire happen there. I think probably everybody will have the sense to do that, but it does does raise the question of what you do. I mean, the emerging plan seems to be something along, it's being called, Fatah Land versus Hamastan. In other words, go ahead and let there be, in effect,
two Palestinian states.
Two Palestinian, you know, quasi-states, reward the good one as a lesson to the people in the bad one. This was kind of laid out by Martin Indyk in a Washington Post op-ed. Seems to be what they're going to try to do. This was critiqued by Daniel Levy in a post that we'll also link to. I don't really have a great idea. I mean, I actually thought back when Hamas, in effect, won the elections that we should have played ball with them then. And certainly, because I thought, you know, there's no way they're overnight going to renounce their longstanding opposition to the existence of Israel. You're going to have to kind of wean them away from that. Certainly, the virtue of playing ball with them then would have been, at least then you would have been rewarding them for for legitimate political activity and sustaining a longstanding ceasefire. Now, in effect, you would be rewarding them for killing people. So I don't know what to do. On the other hand, it's hard for me to imagine this kind of, well, a new kind of two-state solution, you might call it, the Fatah Land versus Hamastan. It's hard for me to imagine the end game, you know, the process by which Hamas kind of, you know, I don't imagine Hamas kind of capitulating on the one hand, you know, now that their back's against the wall, saying, oh, you were right all along, now we will recognize Israel. That doesn't seem to be in the cards. So,
I agree. No, in fact, I think it'd even go even further. I mean, you know, Hamas is in control of Gaza. The assumption presumes that Fatah can actually run the West Bank. Now, the wild card in all this is, I don't know what the strength of Hamas is in the West Bank, but I would be willing to bet that if this two-state solution, you know, the sort of Palestinian two-state solution goes forward, Fatah, because they are so unbelievably corrupt, is not going to be able to manage the West Bank terribly well, and what you're going to wind up having is Hamas, you know, growing strength in the West Bank as well. So I'm not sure it's a stable solution.
Yeah, well, the other thing is the fact that Fatah will be backed so conspicuously by the U.S. and Israel will not shore up their credibility in all Palestinian circles.
Right.
Especially if that's coupled with visible suffering on the part of Palestinians in Gaza.
Right. And, I mean, this goes back to a larger problem that I think, you know, promoters of democracy in the Middle East. I mean, you know, back in the 90s, I mean, there was a general, genuine belief that that if you gave the Palestinians some measure of democracy, it would work well in terms of fostering a two-state solution, because then the Israelis could actually trust the Palestinians. The problem you've got, and again, this also goes to Iraq, is that it's clear that there are parties in the Middle East that are perfectly willing to play the democratic game, but that does not necessarily mean they're willing to give up the extra-legal means through which they can influence policy. In the case of Hamas or Fatah, the fact that they actually, you know, can engage in terrorist attacks on each other. Forget Israel at this point.
Mm-hmm.
They engage in armed attacks on each other. So the problem is that, you know, in in a lot of the rest of the world, the notion is that democracy crowds out other forms of political contestation. The problem you've got in the Middle East is that, you know, Democrat elections don't necessarily have anything to do with other forms of political contestation. It just adds another layer.
Right. No, it seems to me you have to use... I mean, the election would have been the mechanism by which you got Hamas into a position of political leadership, after which the actual challenge arises of using levers at your disposal, including acceptance in the international community, to start changing
right.
their behavior. And it would be a long, slow process, and that's one reason that solution was not appealing to people to begin with, even though it seemed to me the least bad alternative.
Right.
It's a mess, and I also wonder, you know, the kind of two-state approach, won't that, you know, one great concern about Hamas is that more and more they're getting support from Iran, and won't isolating Hamas in Gaza tend to drive them more thoroughly into the arms of Iran, or am I missing something?
I mean, I suppose it would, although one could argue that keeping them... It's going to be tougher for Iran to influence. I mean, maybe this is just simple geography, but it strikes me that it will be tougher for the Iranians to communicate with Hamas in Gaza as opposed to the West Bank. The fact is, it's much easier for the Israelis and the Egyptians to just, you know, cut off Gaza in a way that it's not necessarily the case of the West Bank because of the long border with Jordan. So my just, you know, gut-level assumption would be that the Iranians would have much more influence over these groups, assuming that they're in the West Bank as opposed to Gaza.
Yeah, maybe, oddly, a goal should be to make Gaza and Hamas quite dependent on Egypt relative to Iran, because we, you know, that's a much better conduit of influence for us and a healthier one.
I think it's worth pointing out, I mean, I agree with you that it would have been interesting if, you know, once Hamas won, if the U.S. had been willing to say, okay, you know, let's move forward on the hope that they eventually moderate their views. And we didn't handle that terribly well. But on the other hand, I'm not sure Hamas handled it terribly well either. I think they were genuinely surprised once they took power that other parties actually expected them to change their position on this and that there would actually be real consequences to not doing it.
Yeah, well, I think everybody was surprised. I will say this, and I actually did I remember bringing this up in a dialogue with Mickey at the time. I fairly, you know, maybe not comprehensively, but I paid a lot of attention to what Hamas leaders were saying in the immediate aftermath of the election.
Right.
And they were all going to tremendous pains not to reiterate the traditional opposition to an Israeli state. I don't think you can find any of them saying that. And there were several of them, I had them on tape, on TV, being asked about it. And they were going through these awkward locutions. They definitely were not reiterating the standard opposition to the state of Israel. They seemed to understand that it was not in their interest to do that right away. But the,
right.
but the story that emerged, because of the way we had set the goal line, that is to say, you know, are they going to renounce their traditional position? The story that emerged was, well, Hamas has not renounced its traditional opposition.
Right.
And of course they're not going to renounce. You know, I mean, that was an unrealistic expectation. So I thought I actually saw a certain amount of, now it may have been totally disingenuous and cynical that they were refraining from laying out the traditional doctrine. But
if memory serves, also wasn't a question whether they were speaking in English as opposed to Arabic, because I mean there were claims, if I remember correctly, and it might, you can correct me if my memory is wrong, that they would say one thing to the Western media, but if it was a Palestinian media, they say something entirely different.
That could be. That's a long-standing issue, and I am thinking mainly of the English utterances. There was also the split between the people in the occupied territory and the more radical people in Syria. But it's in a way the most interesting thing I saw come out of this was just a post on what is it? Is it American Footprints? Do you know that blog?
I've heard of it, yeah.
Yeah. A blogger named Haggai, who I think is male, just had a post that's not necessarily related to this, but he apparently has this longstanding view that, look, the only way to go about finding peace is instead of trying to set in motion a dialogue that is supposed to eventually get you to a detailed two-state solution, get outside powers together, as I understand what he's saying, you know, America, Europe, presumably Jordan and you know, Egypt and Saudi Arabia and Russia, whoever, get them together and see if there's something they can agree on in the way of a detailed two-state solution and say, okay, this is it. You know, if we think this is reasonable, if you don't agree to it, you're part of the problem. And that's something you could actually do even in this situation when you have, in effect, three parties. In other words, put something reasonable out there. If Israel and Fatah agrees to it and Hamas doesn't, then the Palestinian people can see what they could have had and see that Hamas is the stumbling block. But anyway,
it's possible. I mean, there's some issues that crop up immediately. The first is that it's not clear to me that you can get the quartet plus whatever to necessarily be on the same page. I mean, the U.S. is going to have slightly different positions on this than other countries, and it's not clear that there's a bargaining set within the group of actions you're talking about. The second thing, and this is not insignificant, is that what's on their polling in Israel now? Is it actually under 5%?
What's his polling? It's low. It's low.
It actually makes George W. Bush look popular. One of the problems is that the democratic legitimacy or the legitimacy of the leaders of all three of those parties, are not necessarily at their peak.
Right.
So this could be a moment of opportunity. That one way to spin this is precisely because their legitimacy is so low, they'll be willing to agree to anything as a way to pump up their legitimacy. Except the way things work in the Middle East, I tend to think it's going to cut the other direction.
Well, especially since the crisis of legitimacy is associated with a certain degree of insecurity in the wake of the Lebanon thing. I think insecurity does not put people in the mood to do generous land deals.
Yeah. That's exactly my – yeah. So, I mean, my guess is the problem you've got – and the problem you've got is the fact is that it's not – it's never been a great time to, over the past, 6 or 7 years to try to broker a Middle East peace deal. It is a uniquely bad time right now in terms of Israel-Palestine. So, I was reading Barack Obama has this piece in the latest issue of Foreign Affairs about what his approach to foreign policy will be. And one of the things he says is, I'm going to, make a major push for Israel-Palestine, try to look for an appropriate Palestinian partner, and we'll cut a deal. And I was just reading it thinking it sounds good, but it doesn't necessarily differ in any way from what the Bush administration ostensibly is doing, although perhaps it will be slightly less friendly to Israel. It's just that the situation on the ground is incredibly difficult, and I'm not sure there's much the U.S. can do.
Well, there may not be. There's a lot of things I would have done differently than the Bush administration myself.
No doubt, absolutely.
And I think in the end, you have to be willing to twist arms. But and Bush has kind of shown no special tendency there. But
no, if anything, he twisted the arms of the Israelis so that they would not conduct a deal with the Syrians.
Well,
so.
Right, that's true. That's true. He's trying to push Israel to the right.
That's got to be the one most bizarre, moment in this whole thing. But I agree with you. The Bush administration, it's not like there are ways in which you could have done it differently. But looking at the situation now, moving forward, I'm not sure that anyone. I'm not sure if Barack Obama gets elected president, there's any greater likelihood of a Israel-Palestinian deal.
Well, I would guess there's a greater one, but that's like greater than zero, so that is not necessarily very high. But I agree with you. Things are at least as disturbing as previously. So we saw that problem. There's a somewhat related issue you're involved in your blog. This guy Norman Finkelstein or Stein.
I think it's Finkelstein, but I won't swear to that.
Okay. Who is, I guess, I'm only vaguely aware of that name. He opines on this very issue, that is the Israel in the Middle East. He is, I gather, fairly far to the left.
That would be an understatement. Yes.
Okay. And he was denied tenure at DePaul. Right. And at that point, you stepped in bravely to comment on the situation.
I'm not sure bravely is the word, but...
Stupidly.
Finkelstein, he talks about the Middle East, but his actual area of scholarship has more to do with the extent to which the Holocaust has affected, sort of American Jews in terms of support of Israel. It basically, what Finkelstein is arguing, and it's a controversial argument, U.S. Jews have created this Holocaust industry as a way to sort of completely silence debate on support of Israel, and therefore, as a result, the U.S. has supported Israel, its various, Zionist aggressions against Palestine in violation of international law and everywhere else. These are Finkelstein's words, not mine. Now, the Holocaust industry argument has been made by him. It's also been made by people like Peter Novick and others. And, you know, Finkelstein in doing this has not been shy about labeling, you know, other kinds of Holocaust scholars as hucksters. He accused Alan Dershowitz of plagiarism. He's, you know, he published an actual book pretty much devoted to explaining why he thought Dershowitz was wrong in the case for Israel. You know, he's managed to, he's got a unique ability to piss off a lot of people. Anyway, he went up for tenure in DePaul. The Department of Political Science voted in favor of him. He also got approved at the level above that, but the university-wide promotions and tenure board decided against it, in large part because the dean of the school and the president of the school wrote to him and basically said that what he had done, his scholarship, they thought his scholarship was above the bar, but that some of his writings were uniquely or deliberately hurtful to other scholars, and that therefore this displayed a lack of collegiality, and therefore that was the reason to deny him tenure. Now, as someone who has a more than passing interest in getting denied tenure at a Chicago-based institution,
The University of Chicago?
Yes, in my case, the University of Chicago. Yeah, just the Chicago area. You know, anyone else gets denied tenure at the University of Chicago in a political science department, I'll be a little interested. I took a look at sort of the paper trail. I haven't read any of Finkelstein's stuff. It was rather sort of, what was the decision-making process that DePaul went through? And it seems clear that, you know, there might very well be grounds for denying Finkelstein tenure. As you point out, he's way to the left, which is not a reason to deny tenure, except that the only venues that he's published in have pretty much been far-left venues. He has not, as near as I can figure out, published a regular, what's called peer-reviewed article, even though he's been in the discipline for 20 years. It takes a lot of work not to do that after 20 years. So, I mean, that would be a potentially valid reason to reject someone. But that's not why they did it. In fact, the department met, voted, decided, no, he meets our scholarship requirements. You know, he's published a couple of books, one of which is a university press book. And it was this lack of collegiality. And, you know, to be uncollegial myself, that's just a bullshit allegation. You know, if we were to reject people for tenure based on lack of collegiality, we'd be booting out half of the academy. You know, most academics are not terribly polite, particularly in print. And so this strikes me as a uniquely bad reason to deny someone tenure. There might have been others, but that's not the one they used, and they had the opportunity, and they chose not to use it. So, I got to say, I don't think DePaul acquitted itself terribly well during this.
So if they had said, the problem is that he has not published any refereed papers, you would have been fine with that, with their denying.
I would have been fine with that. Yeah, you know, I mean, DePaul is, you know, to be blunt, not the greatest, you know, political science department in the world, but, you know, it's a respectable university. You could certainly, you know, have a stipulation that, yeah, you probably got to, you know, get, you know, one or two articles published in a reasonable journal, mainstream political science journal, to get tenure. He didn't do that. We therefore deny. But that's not what the political science department said. No, we think he's met our scholarship requirements. And furthermore, they also investigated. There's a long, we can link to this afterwards, but there was a long, it's posted somewhere online, where the department actually looked at allegations that he was deliberately hurtful, that he engaged in, you know, slander against Dershowitz, or against Peter Novick, or against a few other people. And they basically concluded, look, you know, it wasn't the most pleasant of interactions, but no, Finkelstein was in no way excessively, you know, slanderous. You know, I think that should be his motto if he tries to get another job. You know,
in no way excessively slanderous.
In no way
that's
excessively
a great blurb. Remind me to put that on the back of a book. In no way excessively slanderous.
No way excessively slanderous. It's like an old Simpsons episode, you know, where Krusty the Clown says, I hardly endorse this product or, you know, corporation. But, you know, so, I mean, he seems to have, you know, I'm not sure I don't think I would terribly like him if I met him, and he doesn't seem like a terribly nice person. But, again, that's not the standard by which you decide tenure or not. And so, again, I think DePaul screwed up.
So, he is farther to the left than a couple of other people who come to mind in comparable recent cases. And these are cases not of granting tenure at the institutions they're at, but of being hired away. And one is Juan Cole. And the other, he sounds farther to the left than Juan Cole, although Juan Cole is definitely...
Juan Cole's pretty left, I was going to say, yeah.
Yeah, there's something that puzzles me about him, but let me say the other example, lower profile, is Rashid Khalidi. who I think was courted by Princeton, and somebody kind of intervened.
Yeah, although let's be clear, you know, Khalidi was at University of Chicago with a, I think, an endowed chair, and then got lured away to Columbia, where he has an endowed chair. If Khalidi's going to claim that, he's done pretty well for himself.
Yeah.
I think part of the reason Finkelstein gets into trouble is that, and this actually might be it is where the collegiality does play an issue, because it actually blunts. Even if tenure decisions should not factor that sort of stuff in, I do think sort of external raids do factor this kind of stuff in. In other words, if another department was thinking, hey, Finkelstein's published a lot of stuff, he's making waves, maybe we should hire him. If you read the stuff and he comes across as particularly nasty, that will actually have a deterrent effect, I think, on other universities.
Yeah.
And so it is something of a paradox that I do think the ability to play nice with others, not nice in the sense of, I'm going to hold off criticism, but rather I'm going to do the criticism in a constructive manner, not doubting your, motives in whatever you say, you'll get more interest than if you just, call someone who writes about the Holocaust a complete, poster or a fraud.
Right. Although, actually, it wasn't his colleagues at DePaul who were the ones he would have been hostile toward, right? It was,
telling that the department at DePaul voted 9-3 in favor. I think the minority group did, file a minority report, but that's their prerogative, and that's sort of standard. There's nothing wrong with that. I mean, again, it sounds, and he was also apparently got decent teaching ratings as well, which at a place like DePaul should matter. So, this is one of those things where, as an academic, you believe in academic freedom as a, general value for promoting the marketplace of ideas. This is the kind of thing where even if I find the guy's ideas repellent, it's precisely because I find the guy's ideas repellent that I want to make sure that if he meets the necessary criteria, he gets tenure somewhere. Because it's, easy to point out when someone, got screwed because you're sympathetic with their views. I can't stand this guy's views, and I think he got screwed.
And you posted to that effect and were reminded once again why bloggers generally shy away from posting anything related to Israel, right?
No, it's true. I do not normally blog about Israel-Palestine stuff. I waded into the Israel lobby business when John Mearsheimer and Steve Wall published the essay last year. And God help me when the book comes out. I'm not looking forward to that.
You don't want to do a blogging heads with Mearsheimer, your old colleague at the University of Chicago?
You're proposing that I do a blogging heads with Mearsheimer on the Israel lobby.
Yeah.
I will accept that throwdown.
Will you?
Absolutely. I'm daring
will you,
John. I will. I don't think John will do it, but I'll be happy to.
You might be surprised. When somebody's got a book coming out, they're generally willing to do a lot of stuff.
That's possibly true, but I suspect John will not want to do it.
But now that you've publicly challenged him, Dan, I mean, this is a gauntlet throwing.
I'm throwing down. I'm gauntlet throwing down. Absolutely. That's an intriguing suggestion.
Excellent.
Anyway, but the point is that whenever you talk, as a blogger, I've found if you talk about Israel-Palestine, it's just a no-win proposition because the comments immediately get nasty. I mean, I posted this on my blog, the sort of standard comment I got, which is like, long blocks of unindented prose where, the Zionists are worse than the Nazis, or the Palestinians are worse than the Nazis. The Nazis have to get brought up one way or the other. There's so much passion on both sides of this issue that it's almost unfathomable to most people who are interested in this issue that someone can come in and say, well, I'm not going to decide the Finkelstein case based on what Finkelstein's arguing. I'm going to decide based on whether I thought the process was kosher.
Right, so to speak.
I
found when writing about this issue that there's basically nothing you can say that will not get you extremely hostile mail from both sides.
Right, exactly. There's no position you can adopt whereby there will not be someone who is more extreme than you on whichever side you adopt.
Yeah.
I think that's the rule of blogging or punditry when it comes to Israel-Palestine.
Yeah, and it's too bad. Because the discussion needs to happen. It's very relevant to America's, national security.
No, it's true, and I agree with you that it's not the Israel lobby argument, it's a different argument. The argument is that because saying anything, even, saying anything on this invites, you know, unbelievable amounts of abuse. The transaction, the barriers to blogging on this or commenting on it are so high that you're right. I think there's an under-provision of, you know, public policy discourse on this issue.
Yeah. And we can count on you to rectify that.
For periodic moments, again, if I'm blogging heads with Mearsheimer, yeah, I'll throw down.
Well, you're throwing down a gauntlet. I don't see how it fails to happen at this point. Okay, so now on to relatively easy things to discuss, India and China.
Yes.
You had a blog post about the problem of, a problem kind of international regulation in a sense, which will bring us shortly to your much-discussed book, All Politics is Global. But this was about kind of food and drug type regulation and the problem of when America is importing, well, when there are drugs in America that either are manufactured there, I guess, or have ingredients that come from India or China,
right.
How exactly do we go about regulating them? You know, you linked to a Washington Post piece that said something like, first, you know, it cited the number of times that the FDA, number of cases where the FDA inspects American kind of drug plants and stuff.
Right.
And then the number of times the FDA inspected comparable plants in India or China, as I understand it, was only 200, but I was shocked to hear it was more than zero. I didn't know the FDA. Does the FDA do inspections abroad like that?
Sure. I mean, because, you know, it would be a valid reason, to deny the importation of those goods if it turns out that they're unsafe. So,
okay, so
I mean, I think it is encouraging that they investigate. Now, this is going to be an interesting trend because, you know, for all the talk about sort of, you know, bashing China because of currency manipulation or, intellectual property rights violations or because of the trade deficit, this is a much more interesting problem because it's not nearly as clear-cut in terms of sort of protectionists on the one hand and free traders on the other. There was another story I linked to, which was a USA Today story about the regulation of lead in jewelry, children's jewelry that's being made in China. You know, the FDA basically wants to issue a new regulation, or not the FDA, the Consumer Safety Agency, wants to issue a new regulation saying, okay, there's got to be limited amounts of lead in child jewelry because children, being children, will put the jewelry in their mouth. You know, they can ingest lead, it can potentially be toxic, all these kinds of reasons. They sent out requests for comments. My understanding is that the only request for comment that opposed this new regulation was the Chinese Toy Manufacturing Association, because they just suggested, well, why can't you put a warning label in the jewelry, might contain lead. Lead, drugs, the business with the dog food that happened a few weeks ago. As we import a wider variety of goods from China and India, there's going to be greater concerns, some of which are justifiable, about consumer health and safety. The interesting question, I think the Post story was particularly intriguing about this, is when are these objections, when is the call for greater regulation, a genuine call for greater regulation, and when is it really the still guise for protectionism? I mean, I think the Chinese pharmaceutical guy pointed out correctly, you have to take a grain of salt if the U.S. pharmaceutical, producers say we need to inspect the Chinese producers. Gee, why might they be doing that? Might they have a personal interest in doing that? And the answer is, yes, they very well might have a personal interest. That doesn't mean they're wrong. And this raises an interesting sort of poli-sci issue that Daniel Kono from UC Davis wrote a great piece in the American Political Science Review back in the fall showing that there are different kinds of ways to block trade. Tariffs are the most obvious ones, and they've been a little bit discredited, but using things like regulatory standards are, much, much less transparent and sometimes generate positive benefits as well, so it's much less clear-cut. And I think we're about to enter that arena with both China and India because of the wider array of products that they manufacture.
Right, and this cuts across a lot of areas. I mean, one question, the Bush administration, in kind of a watershed in a way, Republican administration accepting the concept of labor accords in a trade agreement, in a South American bilateral deal. And,
right.
The big question there is, okay, American labor is for that, but is that, do they really want to see the regulation or do they just want to stop the trade? And all kinds of issues like this can be used in principle for either protectionism or actual valid regulation.
Right. I would argue that labor pretty much just wants the protectionism. I mean, labor has opposed every single trade deal on the, you know, that's been on the books for the last 15 years. You know, they don't like the U.S.-Korea free trade agreement because they feel the Korean trade unions are somehow being repressed. And I've seen Korea trade unions in action. They're not repressed all that much. Now, that said, I still do think there are genuine labor issues, for example, for a free trade agreement with Colombia. Colombian trade union leaders are actually being, you know, disappear, and that's a genuine source of concern. So, yeah, even if they're doing it for their own self-interest, it's not clear that they're wrong in some cases. And there's a whole, you know, it's not just labor anymore. It's going to be environmental regulation, and it's going to be, most importantly, it's going to be consumer health and safety. That's, I think, the next big one. Because consumer health and safety is one where it's going to resonate with a lot of Americans, and it's tougher to make the claim of protectionism there, because if it's consumer groups that are behind this, then, you know, they can act as a front for producer groups.
Right. Although, you know, one thing that occurred to me on this health and safety of you know, drugs and food and stuff is, in a way, the problem is not cases where somebody takes a pill and keels over dead, because the system turns out to be pretty efficient at monitoring that kind of stuff and publicizing it and tracing it back to the source. I've been surprised by a number of cases like this, whether it's E. coli or whatever. A probably bigger problem is the kind of thing that you don't become aware of, where, say, they're watering down drugs. So you're buying, like, cancer drugs that actually don't have the anti-cancer stuff in them. And, in fact, the head of China's FDA or a former, I mean, the equivalent of the former head of China's FDA was, like, sentenced to death recently. I don't know if you caught that.
No, I did not catch that.
For corruption. Involving exactly that kind of thing, tolerating the adulteration of drugs, and that's the kind of thing where you might never find out that thousands of people were, like, failing to be cured or were actually dying, because there isn't the immediate dramatic feedback that poisoning gives you.
Right. I mean, I'm a little optimistic about this, mostly because, I mean, the cases you're talking, I mean, that kind of case, the sort of where the drugs are not quite up to snuff, that's very disturbing. But a lot of these cases are sort of spectacular cases where, you know, poison's put in, or a piece of jewelry is discovered to be nothing but lead, you know, these kinds of things. The fact is that, you know, even Chinese manufacturers have to be concerned about their reputation after a certain point. So, if they get caught, you know, with one of these scandals, they could pretty much kiss, you know, the American market goodbye. And this is actually where the U.S. still retains significant amounts of market power. You know, China might be a growing economy, but a fair amount of Chinese manufacturers rely on the U.S. market. So if their goods are somehow perceived of as substandard, or particularly if they're seen as a threat to the health or safety, that's going to be a huge, huge problem for them. But you're right. I think the more subtler stuff that you're talking about is interesting. Although, again, even in the case I'm talking about, there's a New York Times story that I think came out yesterday or today about trying to divine, like trail back the existence of some sort of glycerin in a drug that came from China that turned out to be poison. And the Chinese, you know, set up basically a brick wall set up a wall of silence. Although I think as we go forward, frankly, if they do that, all the U.S. has to say is, look, we clearly know it was this firm, and we think they actually, you know, we suspect them of being, you know, accused of tampering, in which case U.S. suppliers ain't going to buy from that firm anymore.
Yeah, I think China still kind of viscerally resists transparency as a kind of holdover from the true communist days. But on the other hand, when bad publicity does get out, they seem to just go almost into panic mode in terms of, you know, reform. I mean, I think some people think that's why they sentenced this guy to death.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think it's a show execution, I'm sure.
Yeah.
It won't solve the problem. And you're right. I mean, the way they reacted to the dog food, you know, thing as well was a situation where I think the Chinese immediately implemented new regulations, to try to say we're going to get on top of this. I think one of the interesting things will be over the next year, the Chinese are going to be uniquely vulnerable on this stuff because of the Olympics.
Right.
So that's going to be one way in which you can leverage them. And, yeah, I mean, and the other interesting thing is that, this is going to affect India as well. I think it'll be particularly interesting to compare whether India will be better at responding to this than China, because India, you know, is a democracy and has a relatively strong rule of law, and therefore is going to be just a more transparent, you know, society when it comes to these sorts of issues.
Yeah. Well, one, the fact that we can send the FDA in to inspect their factories does illustrate one theme in your book, All Politics is Global, which is that consuming nations actually have a lot of power relative to producing nations in terms of well, doing things at an international level. I mean, this is really a bilateral international deal, where I guess, where they let us come in and inspect their factories. But you're saying that in general, when you talk about global governance, it's nations that consume a lot that have disproportionate power, which I guess is good news for us because we consume a lot.
We're very good at that.
We're very good at
Americans
that.
Americans, we're the most efficient consumers in the world. There's no question about that. No, this is the theme of the book, All Politics is Global. And also there's I can shamelessly plug, I'm having an exchange now over at Cato Unbound with Cal Rascaiola, Jeremy Rapkin, and Anne Florini about these issues. You know, and they were pointing out, well, what about the rise of China and the rise of India? And, you know, as I've certainly said in my foreign affairs piece and a few others, yeah, they're going to matter, but, you know, they matter now as producers much more than consumers. And it's when it comes to regulation, I do think it's the consumption power that's more important than productive power.
Okay. And, you know, I'm curious, you brought up Cato, which is, of course, libertarian. And you refer to yourself as a libertarian, I think.
Right.
But, you know, you don't, on these international relations, you don't have what some people might assume is the default libertarian position. You would think that the extreme case of the libertarian position in international affairs is none of these international institutions should even exist. That's really not, I mean, you're not against, presumably, the existence of the WTO. You're not against the existence of the World Bank. You're right. I mean,
I'm a little less friendly with the World Bank, but yeah, I mean, on the whole, given that it exists, I don't want to get rid of it. I mean, this is the difference between, I guess it's in part the difference between sort of when I have my political science hat on and I have my libertarian hat on. I mean, the book All Politics is Global is about the way the world is. There's not a lot of normative recommendations contained in it. So I really don't care what I would actually want to see happen. What I just want to do is describe what's actually happening. Now, that said, this does raise an interesting question about, you know, well, how do I feel about that? You know, on the one hand, I'm a libertarian. On the other hand, as a libertarian who studies international relations, I have almost an awe for the power of the state as an international actor to basically prevent, you know, if it tries to compete against other forms of authority out there, like, let's say, multinational corporations, non-governmental organizations, even international organizations, on the whole, the state wins pretty much every time. And the more powerful states, you know, tend to trump weaker states. So, you know, part of this is that in the international realm is, in some ways, the absence of world government is precisely what libertarians like to talk about. But there's also competing forms of authority. I mean, yes, the WTO exists, but it's not the only source of, let's say, trade authority out there. There's also, you know, NAFTA. There's also the European Union. There's also a host of bilateral deals. There's ASEAN. You know, there's competing and shifting fora. And that does actually impose a check on global governance, a libertarian-style check. Although, I'm not sure how effective it'll be. I mean, this is actually the subject of the book that I'm going to work on now, going forward.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, you alluded to one of your big themes, which is that the nation-state is bigger than some globalization aficionados would have it, for example, in controlling things like the Internet, right?
China
is having more success in controlling access to information than say, the John Perry Barlows of the world might have been saying, you know, 15 years ago.
Or even the Tom Friedmans and Nick Kristof, yeah.
Okay, and I'm really trying to get kind of to the bottom of that and figure it out. I mean, on the one hand, you know, I'm old enough to remember a fair amount of the Cold War. You're old enough to remember some of it. China is certainly much more porous to information than it was in the Cold War. On the other hand, you have a problem of controlling variables there because it has shifted to a free market system. You know, if it had shifted to a free market system before the Internet, it would have to become somewhat more porous to information, right? And so it's hard to tell how much to attribute to the Internet. I mean, it still is my basic feeling that if a country wants to be truly prosperous, cutting-edge prosperous, that is to say, have a free market system and give people the tools they need to operate effectively within a free market system, which is to say tools of electronic information processing and dissemination, then it has to accept some real decentralization of power away from the state. It can choose to be just impoverished, like North Korea. You know, you can make that choice. But if it opts for prosperity, my feeling is it's going to have to become much freer, both in terms of the decentralized internal flow of information and in terms of kind of the porousness of information from the outside world, much more so than the communist states were in the Cold War. Does that seem wrong to you?
I think that's fair. The problem is that the communist states of the Cold War are such an extreme that it's not clear to me that saying they have to be freer than that means all that much. I mean, I think a classic example to bring up is Singapore. Singapore is, you know, by pretty much any metric you want to use, a rich society. And yet, I would not describe it as free. And I don't think Freedom House describes it as free either. In fact, there are very, very sophisticated controls on, you know, information in terms of both sort of, you know, print periodicals and what can be accessed on the Internet. And Singapore is the template that China is borrowing from and that a lot of other countries are going to borrow from. And the Singaporean system shows no sign of toppling, I would add. And now part of this raises another issue, which is, you know, there's this sort of naive assumption by Friedman and others that, oh, as more information gets into China, as more information gets into Singapore, they will realize, you know, that their governments are repressive, they will begin to demand more autonomy, more rights, and, you know, eventually we will see Madisonian democracy emerge in these countries. The thing that misses is nationalism. And it's important to realize, because the Chinese, you know, the instances where the Chinese government has actually seemed to lose contemporarily control over the populace have not come because, you know, because of Tiananmen Square style sort of calling for democracy, but rather things like anti-Japanese riots or riots following the accidental bombing of the Belgrade embassy. Their embassy in Belgrade during the Kosovo War. There's a fair amount of nationalism in China, and that's actually, I think, the most potent force that the Chinese government hasn't necessarily got control of. And that's not necessarily a liberal force. So even if, I think you need two things. You need the means through which liberals can potentially get access to information, but you also need people who actually want to think in a more cosmopolitan manner, I guess would be the way to put it. And it's not clear to me you've got a large number of people in either China or Singapore who think that way.
Yeah, I mean, there have been as well these peasant uprisings against the upper class in China.
But the peasant uprisings do not have anything to do with you're repressing our access to information. The peasant riots have everything to do with you're not providing decent public goods, goddammit. You know,
right. But if you look at the mechanisms by which the uprisings happen, they involve things like cell phones to mobilize the masses.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. And that is an interest group using information technology to communicate and coordinate the exertion of power. And
no, that's true. And I actually wrote a piece about this that I need to play somewhere. But one of the things I argued was that one of the problems is that, you know, you always measure how secure authoritarian states are by, well, how well are they repressing dissent? Do you see, you know, uprisings or not? And the problem is that this can actually, in an internet or in a cell phone age, in a texting era, I think this can actually lead to a false sense of security to some extent by the authoritarian state, which is you can have uprisings that happen so spontaneously and so quickly that you get this sort of cascade effect where literally everything can topple within a week. The problem as a political scientist, of course, is that it's almost impossible to predict when it will happen. And so part of the problem I think that we have going forward is that, you know, people that, you know, the claims that the Internet is destabilizing the ability to coerce in these countries, you're almost not going to know until the government falls, if it ever does. And so it makes it very hard to figure out how you should cope with these countries and what sort of policies you should promote in the future. And it means that, you know, the tools of political science are not going to be of much use, unfortunately. At least that's what I would think.
Yeah, I mean, I do think there's some evidence, though, that some feedback has gotten through to the Chinese government in terms of how high-handedly they can treat these peasants in terms of, like, ruining their environment, poisoning their lakes and stuff like that.
Right. Well, and there's something else that you should realize, which is, you know, the Chinese government has actually been quite, you know, apparently transparent in terms of talking about the number of rides that are coming up. And you would think ordinarily they wouldn't be like this. So part of what I think the suspicion that's going on is that people like Hu Jintao are actually publicizing these numbers as an excuse when the next party congress comes, which is in 2008, to say, look, we've got rebellions in the peasantry. We need more coercive control. Hmm. You know, it's a classic justification for why you need a stronger state, not a weaker state.
Right. Well, that will be the struggle. But I want to be clear. I'm not saying that the protest in these cases is fueled by a kind of liberal indignation about the suppression of information. I'm saying material interests will motivate the protest, economic interests, whatever. But the information
technology will be used
as tools.
No, that's a valid point. I think that is correct. And things like texting, in particular, are much more so than the internet, actually. I think can be a very powerful force, not just even in China, but also there's evidence that it works in the Middle East, too.
Yeah. No, there's been a lot of that. We were going to talk about some other things. I don't know. We're probably can't fit them all in. What's your favorite? If you had to choose among several of the following, Putin, pundits, sports, and movies, what would you choose, Dan?
I'll go with sports and pundits for 2005.
Okay, but you're the one who says you haven't been following the sports lately, right?
Well, when you ask me about sports,
I have an all-politics-is global question for you about sports. Is it a...
Oh, this is cool, okay.
I mean, it's not that directly related to your book, but somewhat germane. Just, this week was a good week for Argentina and American sports. I mean,
First
of all, as a trivia question, can you tell me how?
Well, I believe Angel Cabrera, who's an Argentinian, won the U.S. Open yesterday.
Excellent.
Manu Ginobili, who was a member of the Argentinian gold medal basketball team of 2000, is also a member of the San Antonio Spurs, which just won the NBA Finals.
You're two for two.
Is there a three for three?
No. You've already exceeded my wildest expectations. But I was thinking about when Cabrera was being awarded the trophy yesterday, and it was this nice scene, American fans applauding warmly, even though he hadn't been, the national favorite, and Tiger Woods saying nice things about him and so on. I was thinking, this probably does as much good for America's image in a given country as, all kinds of arduously arrived at policies intended to do good for Americans. Do you think that's crazy to think that sports is a really, just an important medium of international communication and of conveying an image and of ultimately in that way influencing geopolitics?
I think potentially. I mean, it's funny. I wrote a piece for the Washington Post last year called The Soccer Wars because when the World Cup started, there were these ESPN ads claiming that, the power of sports, that, like, soccer stopped the war, because the country in Western Africa, and I can't remember which one now, I think it's Guinea, Equatorial Guinea, the country, by qualifying for the World Cup, led to a ceasefire. I think the behavior of Americans the behavior of American fans and the receptivity to foreign players is actually something that I think the United States should justly be proud of, because the contrast, let's say, between how Americans, welcome Argentinian golfers, Serbian basketball players, Dominican, baseball players, there's almost at this point almost zero sort of racial antagonisms on that front. Whereas, let's say, a Nigerian soccer player in Europe will face those taunts,
mm-hmm.
And it doesn't speak well for Europe. So I think that's true. And actually, I think, given that there's been all this roiling about the immigration debate over the last couple weeks, I think it's telling that, in fact, can you imagine how Americans would react if we suddenly imposed, immigration restrictions on athletes? but the only group that I think would support this, interestingly enough, are some players. I mean, Gary Sheffield got into some hot water. Are you aware of the comments he made?
I'm not. About Hispanics or what?
Yeah, Gary Sheffield was interviewed, he's a player for the Detroit Tigers, he's an outspoken baseball player, and also got the most vicious baseball swing I've ever seen in my life at the plate. Sheffield basically made this argument that Major League Baseball was catering to, Latin American players more than African American players, because the Latin American players can be under the thumb of the owners, since they sign contracts such that they're afraid of being deported if they lose their job. Whereas African-Americans know they're going to stay in this country. And, I think pretty much, again, it's a BS argument. because Major League Baseball has actually gone out of their way to start, you know, developing, you know, inner-city baseball programs. And furthermore, you know, no baseball team is going to say, let's not hire this, let's not draft this kid because he's an American citizen. We can sign this other kid who's not nearly as good for less money. It's not, that's not how it works.
Yeah, I mean, baseball owners, I mean, first of all, I think they... athletic team owners tend not to be motivated fundamentally by profit, which is good because a lot of them don't make money. I mean, they basically want, above all, to win a championship, and it's hard to imagine, you know, anything kind of getting in the way of that in their motivational structure.
And also what Sheffield and a lot of people overlook is, you know, they focus on the declining, and it's true, there's a declining degree of participation by, you know, U.S.-born African-Americans in baseball. That completely overlooks the fact that they have dominated other sports during the same era. And that it, partly what might be happening is not so much that Americans would be, or that blacks are being crowded out of baseball, but rather that when choosing between baseball as opposed to basketball or football, they will choose the latter two options because in terms of the contracts that are signed in professional sports, those latter two sports are much, athletes are much more likely to get larger amounts of money much earlier in their careers. Whereas in baseball, if you sign a contract, you normally are going to have at least 2, 3, 4 years playing in the minor leagues before you really hit the big money. Whereas in both football and basketball, if you're drafted, you get to play almost immediately at the professional level.
Okay. I accept your word on that.
There we go.
You've demonstrated your mastery of sports. Did you want to demonstrate your mastery of summer movies?
Of summer movies?
Yeah.
No, except I will simply give my advice. Do not under any circumstances see Fantastic Four Rise of the Silver Surfer. I went to see that movie yesterday with a friend. I feel very guilty about it because I promoted the box office sales. And dear God, it sucked ass. I will say I did see Knocked Up.
I was going to ask. Have you seen it? Yeah. I have not seen anything ever. But I saw the New York Times cover story on the director of that. And
yeah, Judd Apatow.
Yeah. How is it?
It is incredibly funny. It is both funny and actually real characters. It's an even better version of the 40-year-old virgin. Because the 40-year-old virgin was funny and it was sweet, but it was about, let's face it, a slightly oddball character. Whereas this movie is much more, I guess the themes are a little more general, you know, universal, I guess would be the way to put it. And what's funny about this movie is that, I mean, I saw it with my wife. We laughed our asses off when we saw it. And yet, whenever we describe it to people, it almost sounds like a tragedy. You know, the funniest parts are almost, you know, it's got this Everybody Loves Raymond feel to it, actually. Did you ever watch that show?
About once or twice.
I mean, the thing about Everybody Loves Raymond is that it's very funny, and yet if you actually got rid of the laugh track,
Kind of pathetic.
Not pathetic, but there are serious, like, grudges, you know, between the family members, you know, and that they're not necessarily reconcilable. And that there's some of that comes up in this movie, you know, just about how men are idiots and, you know, but, you know, that women can be controlling and, you know, the ways in which marriages are, you know, and having children, you know, require almost constant negotiation between marriage partners. It's not an easy thing to do.
Yeah. Well, the line on this director is that he instills kind of family values in a non-heartwarming, kind of ironic, you know, non-romantic, I guess, realist way, right?
If I had to use three words to describe Judd Apatow's movie, it would be fucking family values. Because these movies are the most profane movies you can possibly imagine, you know, and God knows they've got relatively, you know, open ideas with regard to sex and drugs and rock and roll. But in the end, you're right, there are, you know, I mean, there's been a small debate about this movie, Knocked Up, about whether or not, you know, I mean, the plot of the movie, which won't surprise anyone, is basically, you know, loser stoner guy impregnates incredibly hot woman decides to keep baby. And there was, you know, there's like 5 minutes where they deal with the question of abortion in the movie, and they never say the word in the movie. And in fact, one of the characters sort of mocks this and says, what about the rhymes with schmishmorshman, you know? And it's the way the movie framed it, it was clear that was not going to be a serious option.
Uh-huh.
So you're right. I mean, in the end, these are about concern. And the 40-year-old version was the same, in which the idea of just sort of casual sex was generally, in the end, frowned upon. That the idea was this: the Steve Carell character was right to wait until he got married, until he had sex.
Okay. Well, that is family values.
So does our family values.
But the director is not right wing. I mean, he wouldn't be thought of as a conservative. He's not part of the Republican base, right?
No, absolutely not. And as I said, if you were to bring a member of the Family Research Council to this, I suspect they would turn to ashes within the first 5 minutes of the movie. I mean, the language is unbelievable. In Knocked Up in particular, there are actual vagina shots during birth. I mean, it's incredibly disgusting.
Well, that changes it.
Lots of drug use, on other dimensions, put it this way, it depends on what kind of family values you're talking about. If you're talking about the importance of love and marriage, incredibly family values. If you're talking about, drugs and other things, no, I wouldn't say it's terribly family value friendly.
Okay. Well, so at least he's not preaching to the choir then.
This is part
of the outreach movement for family values.
No, it's true. In fact, I think I've actually heard discussions about this, about how, that people, guys are accusing Judd Apatow of making chick flicks that appeal to guys. Because in the end, these are obviously movies that young men want to see, but in the end, he's actually bombarding them with, like, chick flick values. It's an interesting... It's an interesting combination.
Yeah. Well, I should go, I'll add this to the list of movies that I shamefully have not seen.
As my wife and Alex put it, Knocked Up is a sitter-worthy movie.
So you've tossed out two or three blurbs for this movie. I mean, you've been working on this.
I don't get to see that many movies, so, I do get to see when I'm willing.
Well, I've heard only good things about it, and I should really... You think my wife would like it?
I think you would, yes. I think you would like it. I do. I don't know your general taste in movies, but assuming you're not put off by language or drug use, yeah, I think you'll like it.
I'm not. And you think my wife would like it, too. It's chick-friendly.
It is a very chick-friendly movie. And, in fact, actually, the most interesting performance is by a woman, Leslie Mann, who is the director's wife. She plays the sister of the woman, of Katherine Heigl, and is both funny and tragic in the movie. It's a very interesting.
Okay. Well, I mean, you're just like a Renaissance man. I mean, we've gone from your book on global regulation to sports to movies, and just finally, your book is kind of ironically titled, right? Because you're pointing to, in a lot of ways, how politics remains local.
That's correct. Well, I opened with the point that the topics have now become debated globally, but in fact, the source of the preferences and the source of the power. Remains national, which was actually O'Neill's point when he said all politics is local. So yes, it is. It's a play on words, but I like the title way too much to have said all politics is not global. That would have been terribly boring.
That would have been one twist too many, I think, on the original expression. And
I say you kept with me, point for point during this entire thing. So don't sell yourself short on this topic.
Oh, that's so nice of you. I'll bet you say that to all the all the people like me.
All my blogging head partners.
All your blogging head partners. Finally, we did accomplish this gauntlet throwdown to John Mearsheimer, although it just occurred to me, this had been floating around in my subconscious, I guess, that you, in your blog, had referred to his paper on the Israel lobby as, if I recall correctly, piss-poor monocausal social science. Do I have that right?
Yep, that is correct.
Okay. So he may or may not accept your challenge, but you thrown down the gauntlet, and we'll be in touch.
I look forward to it.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Dan.
Thanks a lot, Bob. It was a lot of fun.
Okay. See you around.
Yep. Bye.
Bye-bye.